Okay, welcome to our podcast, Sounding Off with Kim Munson. I am thrilled to have on the line with me my friend, Ben Martin. He is a patriotic historian. He is a former Army Ranger. And he had actually taught a class about America's founding heritage. And I realized just what a treasure trove of history Ben has. And it just really brought the American founding to life for me. And so Ben joins us on the show each month. This year, we're going through America's, the important speeches and documents of the American founding. And we actually ran out of time from our May 19th show. And we thought, let's go ahead and do a podcast on this so that we can delve a little bit deeper into three men. And that is James Otis, Sam Adams, and Patrick Henry. So, Ben Martin, welcome to the podcast.
Well, I'm so happy to be here today with Kim and you and Steve and all of the American patriots listening out there. And today we're going to talk about the final founder of those three that you talked about in this presentation of the pre-Revolutionary War. And his name is Patrick Henry, who we all know at least a little of. But to let everyone know, he was a brilliant orator and a major figure of the American Revolution. He was the first governor of his independent home state of Virginia. Patrick Henry was the son of John Henry, a well-educated Scotsman who served in the colony as a surveyor, a colonel, and a justice of the Hanover County Court. Before Patrick was 10, he received some rudimentary education from a local school. Later, it was reinforced by tutoring from his father, who was trained in the classics. Like Samuel Adams, Patrick was not a business whiz. As a youth, he failed twice in 7 years as a storekeeper and once as a farmer. In 1754, he married his sweetheart, Sarah Shelton. The demands of a growing family spurred him to study law, and in this profession, he soon displayed remarkable ability. Within a few years after his admission to the bar in 1760, he had a large and profitable clientele. He was especially successful in criminal cases where he made good use of his quick wit, his knowledge of human nature, and his forensic gifts. Meanwhile, his oratorical genius had been revealed in the trial known as the Parson's Cause in 1763. The suit grew out of a Virginia law that was disallowed by King George III that permitted payment of the Anglican clergy in money instead of tobacco when the tobacco crop was poor. Sounds like common sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Henry astonished the audience in the courtroom with his eloquence in evoking the doctrine of natural rights, the political theory that man is born with certain inalienable rights.
Ben Martin, I've heard that somewhere before.
We did. You're very right. Okay. Well, during that next decade, Henry was an influential leader in the patriotic opposition to the British government. He was a member of the First Virginia Committee of Correspondents. Now, we've heard that before in our talks with Otis and Adams. And he was a delegate to the Continental Congress of 1774 and 1775. All this he did in conjunction with Otis and Adams of our first two segments. The Burgesses were sitting in 1774 when word came that Parliament voted to close the Port of Boston and shut down the Massachusetts government. This was all a result of the Boston Tea Party and the Intolerable Acts, which that's what the American colonies call it. The British call them they call them the other acts. They were coercive acts. And several Burgesses, including Henry, convened at the Raleigh Tavern to formulate a response to the closing of their legislature there, too, again, in conjunction with Otis and Adams. Now, according to George Mason, a former Burgess from Fairfax County in Virginia, who joined the committee in the work, Henry took the lead. Mason and Henry would form a close political relationship that would last until Mason's death in 1792. The resolution that Henry's committee produced set 1 June 1774, the date upon which the port of Boston was to be closed, as a day of fasting and prayer, again in conjunction with Otis and Adams of Massachusetts. Henry's resolution passed, but the British government of Virginia, Lord Dunmore, dissolved the legislative body of Virginia, again, part of the Intolerable Acts. Undeterred, the former legislatures met at Raleigh Tavern and reconstituted themselves as a convention to meet again in August. After there was time for the counties' meetings to show local sentiment, they also called for a boycott of tea and other British products, again in conjunction with Otis and Adams. The new Virginia Convention planned 5 meetings. This is really important. These 5 meetings would guide Virginia to independence, as the British authority would, under their ideas, come to an end in Virginia. Their work was advanced by many resolutions of county meetings, as they planned, denying the authority of Parliament over the colonies and calling again for a boycott of British imports. Now, the first Virginia Convention began on 1 August of 1774 in Williamsburg. It met for only a week. One major decision was that the election of Virginia delegates to the first Continental Congress in Philadelphia in 1774, and Henry was chosen as one of the Virginia's 7 delegates to attend that first Continental Congress. That was the first convention. The second Virginia Convention began on 20 May in 1775 in St. John's Church in Richmond, Virginia. Many key people were present in this convention that would be involved in the founding of America and the writing of the Declaration of Independence. All of the above being very important, the centerpiece of the second Virginia Convention was Patrick Henry's speech on 23 March. Henry was convinced that the war with Great Britain was inevitable, and he presented strong resolutions for organizing, equipping, and preparing the Virginia militia to fight against the British, and it ended with his now famous peroration, "Give me liberty or give me death."
Okay, hey, Ben, just a clarification. You said he gave it on 23 March. Did you mean 23 May 1775?
No, 23 March.
Okay, but they had a meeting then May 20th of 1775.
They will have another meeting, but the second Virginia Convention began on 20 March.
Oh, 20 March. I'd written that down wrong. Okay, now I got it. So 3 days in, he gives that speech.
And the speech was on the 23rd of March.
Got it.
And again, it was in the church, St. John's Church in Richmond, Virginia.
Okay,
now after that meeting, it was resolved that the Virginia colony be, and this is in quotes, put into a posture of defense, and that Patrick Henry, Richard Henry Lee, Benjamin Harrison, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and several others, but those names should stand out, that they be a committee to prepare a plan for embodying, arming, and disciplining such a number of men as may be sufficient for that purpose. And the speech was also a contributing factor in the decision by Governor Dunmore to remove the gunpowder from the Williamsburg magazine to a Royal Navy ship in the harbor. And this is an incident called the Gunpowder Incident. Henry's speech also convinced many in Virginia to declare war on Britain, and it assured his fame as one of the great advocates of liberty. Now, the fame which came to Henry from this speech would lead to many opportunities for him to serve his fellow citizens and his new nations as they founded America. Henry's position of public service began with his being named as commander of the 1st Virginia Regiment by the 3rd Virginia Convention, and later Virginia's Committee of Safety would make him the commander of all Virginia military forces. Now, Henry did not sit on the 4th Virginia Convention, which met in December of 1775, because his military commission made him ineligible to do so. So in April of 1776, Henry was elected to the 5th Virginia Convention, which would meet between 6 May and 5 July of 1776. This meeting was one of great consequence for Virginia and the rest of the colonies. In it, they declared Virginia's independence, wrote the Virginia Declaration of Rights on 12 May, and the Virginia State Constitution on 29 June.
And that was in 1776. So I had a couple of questions,
sure,
Ben Martin, and a comment, I guess. It seems to me like I'm seeing some of the things that were occurring with the British that end up in the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights. So Lord Dunsmore says to this legislature, you can't meet.
Right.
And so they assemble, a right to assemble. They go to the Raleigh Tavern. So
correct.
I see that. And then regarding Second Amendment rights, Lord Dunsmore takes away the gunpowder. So obviously then their guns would not be effective if they had no ammunition. I see that correlate with what is happening with some of these legislatures in America today, where they are limiting magazine bans, it seems like they're very closely connected, Ben Martin.
History repeats itself over and over again, and we must learn from it, or we are destined to repeat the same mistakes over and over again. You are so right, Kim. That's a great point to make, and that's what we try to make by learning history, because it's just a history of human nature and the decisions that are made by people that have not learned the lessons from the history before them. And that you don't have a conscience if you don't know the past history. And that's what we're seeing right now. These are many uneducated people out there that are doing this today.
And when you say uneducated, we mean it uneducated that they have not educated themselves to
right.
learn what our history is. It's not an uneducated can't read and write. It's a different kind of uneducated. And so not understanding history, not having the intellectual curiosity to do so, but instead tear history down, I think is a very dangerous thing, Ben Martin.
It's a very dangerous thing, especially when you're tearing. We're doing the same thing. They're doing the same thing that the Taliban did that we thought was so crazy. They destroyed statues, the Taliban, that are 1,000 years old. Mm-hmm. We're destroying statues that are 200 to 400 years, at least their history of them is that old. And it's just crazy that we're doing that, because we're destroying that. So we're not only are we ignorant of past history, those people that learn history today in our institutions of higher learning aren't learning the real history. They're learning this trumped up history that has been taught to us by the regressives of our current time. And so that's one of the reasons why we're doing these things that you're doing, trying to teach American history and the lessons from them that our founders taught us, because they went back to the beginning of recorded history to learn those lessons so that they could found this great government that we have, the greatest government that the world has ever known, the Novus Ordo Seclorum, a government of the people, by the people, for the people. And that had never been done before. And while they were trying to do it, the rest of the world was telling them that they were crazy, that it would never work. But it has worked for over 240 years.
So the American idea is a new idea when you look at history,
right.
When you look throughout. And the American idea...
But it's based on the ancient lessons that we've been taught repeatedly throughout history. So it was a revolutionary idea, but it was really based upon the lessons from history throughout recorded history, throughout our time. So it was new, but it was based upon the lessons from the old that were repeated over and over again.
Fascinating. Okay, so continue on.
Okay, so this 5th Virginia Convention was the last of the 5 that they set up, they planned. And as I said before, this one was very important, and it was very consequential to Virginia and the rest of the colonies, and it declared their independence, the Virginia Declaration of Rights and the Virginia State Constitution. Now, this is to kind of talk about our future, our next program here, and that the Virginia Declaration of Rights was chiefly written by George Mason, and the Virginia Constitution was mainly written by George Mason and James Madison. And we will talk more about these important documents and the men that wrote them in our 5th program on 23 June 2020, this month. I hope that this helps to show, and you've already talked about it, how our American history fits together so nicely and comes from the lessons of ancient history. And when we say Novus Ordo Seclorum, that is the new order of the ages, and that is the government that our founders gave to us. Now, Henry was a key player in the important 5th Virginia Convention. And although a good majority of the delegates were for independence of both Virginia and America, they were not clear on how to get there. And according to Edmund Randolph, a name we'll remember from history, who was a future governor, to be a future governor of Virginia and be a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, Henry showed calm prudence and clear objective reason as he introduced a resolution to explain a plan that would lead Virginia to there, to where they wanted to go, to independence. The eventual resolution he championed passed unanimously on 15 May 1776. As well as declaring Virginia's independent, Henry's resolution instructed the state delegates in the Second Constitutional Congress to press for American independence. Accordingly, Virginia delegates Richard Henry Lee would introduce his now famous independence resolution to Congress on 7 June, and Thomas Jefferson would be the main author of the declaration, which would unanimously pass on 4 July 1776. Under their new constitution, Virginia would elect Patrick Henry, the first governor of their independent state. At that time, he was Virginia's most popular politician, and his election as governor helped assure the acceptance of the new state constitution. In 1777, Henry would be reelected as governor of Virginia without opposition, and in 1778, he would be elected for a third term as governor, again without opposition. On October 9, 1777, Henry would marry Dorothy Dandridge, daughter of Nathaniel Dandridge, which made him closer kin to George Washington because Nathaniel was Martha Washington's uncle. Dorothy and Patrick then moved to Leatherwood Plantation in Henry County, a county the Virginia Assembly created and named for him. As governor in the winter of 1777-78, when Washington's Continental Army was starving in Virginia, Henry sent livestock and other foodstuff to their relief. He also supported Washington in what we know today as the Conway Cabal, and sent Washington a letter that Henry received from Benjamin Rush, which tipped off Washington to the cabal. In 1794, President Washington wrote of Henry, "I have always respected and esteemed him. Nay, more, I have conceived myself under obligation to him for the friendly manner in which he transmitted to me some insidious, anonymous writings in 1777 with a view to embark him in the opposition that was forming against me at that time." From 1784 to 1786, Henry again served as a Virginia governor for 2 more terms, stepping down before he was considered for a 6th term as Virginia government. Now that we have discussed the enormous and positive effects his famous speech and that second Virginia convention had upon his life in the American founding, let us conclude with some unforgettable passages from it.
Okay.
So are we good to go there?
You know what? I had just a couple of questions.
Sure.
First of all, Sarah Shelton, Henry had married her, and then you said he married Dorothy. What happened?
Sarah died in childbirth. You know, that childbirth was a very dangerous thing for the women of that era. And so she died in childbirth, and he remarried Dorothy Dandridge.
Okay.
And then, in 1777.
Okay. And then you just talked about this thing that George Washington had written, and I wasn't quite following. You said that Henry had written some anonymous things, and it sounded to me like it was against George Washington. Did I hear that correctly?
Well, there was a Conway cabal that was started after the first engagements with the British in 1776 in the summer in New York City. And remember, Washington was driven all the way down through New Jersey, across the river, and was on the Pennsylvania side before they had, you know, and that was almost around Christmas time before they had that. Well, at that time, Conway and Gates, those guys were forming a cabal. They were trying to get Washington removed as the commander of the Continental Army. And they were trying to engage Henry, Patrick Henry, in this cabal against George Washington. And so Benjamin Rush sent Henry a letter telling him about the cabal and asking him to become part of that. And what Henry did was he immediately sent that letter to George Washington to tip him off on the cabal. And so George Washington, although it was an anonymous letter to Henry, George Washington recognized the handwriting of Benjamin Rush. And so he knew. And so he was prepared. And he was prepared to act against the cabal. So the cabal never became effective against George Washington. And of course, he was never removed as commander-in-chief.
Okay.
So that's what George Washington was thanking him for in 1794 as he was serving as president of the United States.
Okay, boy, that would have changed history, huh?
It would have changed history quite a bit. But Henry stepped in and did a good thing there. So, and that's what he was comparing to. So if we can go now to this speech that he wrote and that he delivered in 1775 that made him famous and gave him all these opportunities to serve America and to serve his fellow citizens, these positions of great public service, that they all came from this first speech that was in 1775. And so now I'd like to give a few important, famous excerpts from that to the audience.
Okay.
Okay, so Henry, first of all, he addresses this speech to the president, and that president was the president of the convention, and his name was Peyton Randolph. He was a former speaker of the House of Burgesses. So Henry starts off, "Mr. President, no man thinks more highly than I do of the patriotism as well as abilities of the very worthy gentlemen who have just addressed the House. But different men often see the same subject in different lights. I shall speak forth my sentiments freely, without reserve. This is no time for ceremony. The questions before the House is one of awful moment to this country. For my own part, I consider it as nothing less than a question of freedom or slavery, and in proportion to the magnitude of the subject, ought to be freedom of debate. It is only in this way that we can hope to arrive at truth and fulfill the great responsibility we hold to God and to our country."
Wow, right there, I see another thing that is in the Bill of Rights, and that is free speech and to debate these ideas. And Ben Martin, what we are seeing in America today is not this exchange of ideas, this debating to, as Patrick Henry said, to arrive at the truth. Right. And so I think that's really important for listeners to understand that this tapping down by, you know, media and academics to not work towards trying to debate and find truth, I think is a very dangerous thing happening in America today, Ben Martin.
It's a very thing. And the other thing that we add to this is you go through this speech, as I will, you'll see the strength of character that we have here to stand up against odds, to stand up against a public opinion in some cases. That he stands up against that, and you have to show strength, and you have to show optimism, and that's what he does. Because without this speech, Virginia would have never gotten so involved in such an early time in the declaring of independence, as we just talked about with Richard Henry Lee, and, of course, Thomas Jefferson being so involved in this Declaration of Independence, which would eventually lead to our independence against overwhelming odds. And so you see him showing courage there, something you're not seeing from governors and mayors of cities, governors of states and mayors of cities, that we should be seeing right now. We should be seeing political leadership such as our president is showing today. So let me go on and illustrate that.
Okay.
Mr. President, it is natural to man to indulge in the illusion of hope. We are apt to shut our eyes against a painful truth. That's what the mayors are doing. And listen to the songs of that siren till she transforms us into beast. Sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Is this the part of wise men engaged in a great and arduous struggle for liberty? I have but one lamp by which my feet are guided, and that is the lamp of the experience. I know of no way of judging of the future but by the past. And judging by the past, I wish to know what there has been in the conduct of the British ministry for the last 10 years to justify those hopes with which gentlemen have been pleased to solace themselves and the House. Are fleets of armies necessary to work a work of love and reconciliation? Have we shown ourselves to be so unwilling to be reconciled that force must be called in to win back our love? Let us not deceive ourselves, sir. These are the implements of war and subjugation, the last arguments to which kings resort, or we could say tyrants resort. I ask, gentlemen, sir, what means this martial array, if its purpose be not to force us to submission? Can gentlemen assign any other possible motive for it? Has Great Britain any enemy in this quarter of the world to call for all this accumulation of navies and armies? No, sir, she has none. They are meant for us. They can be meant for no other. They are sent over to bind and rivet upon us those chains which the British ministry have been so long forging. Let us not, I beseech you, sir, deceive ourselves. Sir, we have done everything that could be done to avert the storm which is now coming. If we wish to be free, if we mean to preserve inviolate those inestimable privileges for which we have been so long contending, if we mean not basely to abandon the noble struggle in which we have been so long engaged, in which we have pledged ourselves never to abandon until the glorious object of our contest shall be obtained, we must fight. I repeat it, sir. We must fight. An appeal to arms and to the God of hosts is all that is left us. They tell us, sir, we are weak, unable to cope with so formidable an adversary. But when shall we be stronger? Will it be next week or next year? Will it be when we are totally disarmed? And when a British guard shall be stationed in every house? Sir, we are not weak. If we make a proper use of those means which the God of nature has placed in our power. 3 million of people armed in the holy cause of liberty and in such a country as that which we possess are invincible by any force which our enemy can send against us. Besides, sir, we shall not fight our battles alone. There is a just God who presides over the destinies of nations and who will raise up friends to help fight our battles with us. The battle, sir, is not to the strong alone. It is to the vigilant, the active, the brave. Besides, sir, we have no election. If we were base enough to desire it, it is now too late to retire from the contest. There is no retreat but in submission and slavery. Our chains are forged. Their clanking may be heard on the plains of Boston. The war, sir, is inevitable. And let it come. I repeat it, sir. Let it come. It is in vain, sir, to extenuate the matter. Gentlemen may cry, peace, peace. But there is no peace. The war is actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren are already in the field. Why stand we here idle? What is it the gentlemen wish? What would they have? Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it. Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take. But as for me, give me liberty or give me death. And with that, he concluded.
Wow. Ben Martin, that's pretty amazing.
It is. And that shows the kind of courage, individual courage, you have to have against all kind of things that may be seem formidable opponents.
And words are so, so important.
Yeah. And they brought him, like I said, they gave him so many opportunities from that speech to not only inspire people, but to give him these positions, these enormous positions of responsibility of public service, to serve his fellow citizens and to serve his founding nation.
Well, Ben Martin, this has been powerful. What is the final thought that you would like to leave with our listeners today?
I would like to leave to our listeners the thought that we have, because of our founders, we have distilled and summarized all of the lessons of the former history from the beginning of time, and we have brought them into the lessons that our founders have given us in these great documents, the Declaration of Independence, something that had never been done. This Constitution, this great Constitution that we have, that they've taken all these lessons and condensed them and put them into a very workable and the greatest constitution any nation has ever had. And we also have the Federalist Papers, which we talked about all last year, which explains all of those lessons and why they are written the way they are into our form of government, our Republican Constitution. And if people would just read those, it's like what was said, and we've talked about it over time. Before something can become an object of your heart, it must become an object of your head. You must learn it. And it's so beautiful to learn. And once you learn it, you can't help but love it.
Ben Martin, on that note, we'll sign off on Sounding Off with Kim Munson. Be sure and listen to our June 23rd show where we will talk about the Declaration. And Ben Martin, thank you for joining me on this podcast.
Well, you know, it's my pleasure, Kim. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Most definitely. And my friends, God bless you and God bless America.